So last time we considered the elements of relativistic hydrodynamics, but now look at the gravity side of the correspondence, and consider the ADS Schwarzschild background. Black brain background in five dimensions, where the metric is the one you have seen before in tutorials, in the coordinate u, which is useful for our purposes, and the coordinates along the boundary are x, y, and z. And now we have this piece L squared over 4fu squared du squared. And then there's a five sphere, which I'm not going to write down because nothing will depend on the coordinates of this five sphere. It will decouple from any consideration. So this is a five-dimensional five-dimensional background whose perturbations we will consider. So recall that we have a relationship with the metric in the usual radial coordinates such that u was r naught squared over r squared, and the Hawking temperature of this background is r naught over pi l squared. The equations of motion that you were deriving in one of the tutorials in five dimensions were just r mu nu equal to 2 lambda over 3 times g mu nu, right? So that followed from the compactification of the phi form on a phi sphere. So there is this term with cosmological constant lambda in five dimensions being simply equal to minus 6 over L squared. And now our goal is to compute the correlation functions of stress energy tensor. And that means that, so we want the correlation functions of T mu nu, including the one-point functions if we want them at finite temperature. The finite temperature is there, but we are mostly interested in correlation functions of the two-point functions at finite temperature, because we know the prediction. The prediction is that these correlation functions in the hydro limit must have a pole. And we identified the dispersion relations yesterday that should appear as poles of these correlators. So this means that we need to compute. So if you're only interested in poles, and so only poles, in principle, it would be good to compute correlators as well. But so if only poles, then we need the quasi-normal quasi-normal spectrum of gravitational perturbations of this background. So I write down this g mu nu background plus small fluctuations h mu nu, and we want to compute these, solve the equations explicitly. And the h mu nu will depend on the radial coordinate, in this case u. And it will also depend on time. And then because everything is isotropic in terms of the spatial dimensions x, y, and z, I can orient my coordinate system in such a way that that x is z, z is pointing along the momentum. Right? I can always do that because everything is isotropic in these coordinates, and it is my choice to simplify calculations. So I will orient my free momentum along the z direction, and this is possible because I have isotropy. All right. Now, what I do is I take this metric in that form, I substitute in the equation of motion, and you have done this exercise in the tutorial. There are no interferences. There is no interference from F5 form components, although metric enters also the phi form. But you can show that nothing dramatic happens there. And you have the expansion. So your army nu can be expanded in small h's. You linearize the equations of motion, and it is an infinite series with the appropriate powers of h. But we are only interested in the linear term. So this is the background, right? I called it background mu nu plus h mu nu plus possible higher powers, but we are only interested in the. So to lead in order, this is a solution of equations of motion. This is our background. This solves the equations of motion. But then the equation that we are looking at is the linear order term r mu nu 1. Whatever it is, I mean, this is expansion of r mu nu. And it is equal to 2 lambda over 3 times h mu nu. So these are our equations of motion. And it is important to note that other fields decouple. So other fields of type 2b, supergravity, decouple and can be set to zero, right? So this is, I emphasize this point that when you are solving and you're looking for particular correlation functions that couples to certain fluctuation of interest, for example, to h mu nu, you must look at your equations of motion, the full set of equations of motion in whatever dimension they are coming from, if in this case in 10 dimensions. And you have to ensure that when you reduce this problem, you simplify this, you reduce this to 5 dimensions, for example. And you are not interested, for example, in fluctuations of some 2 forms and 4 forms and so on. But you must make sure that all fluctuations that you want to set to zero self-consistently decouple, and they actually can be set to zero without sourcing, without coupling, without sourcing the new terms, non-zero terms in h mu nu. Okay, so this is a very important remark. But in this case, it is indeed so. And then so you have these set of equations. So these are linear partial differential equations. And then I can do further things. So I can, first of all, I can impose a certain gauge. I can fix a gauge. So my field h mu nu. So okay, so let me just continue. So equations of motion split into three classes. And I will impose the gauge m equal to zero, where m is the mu, for example, u mu equal to zero, where mu is the 5-dimensional index, so it includes u and also t, x, y, and z. So I partially fix the gauge, and in this gauge, the equations split into three classes. So class number one is fluctuations with h, x, y not equal to zero, but also h, x, x not equal to h, yy. We will see in a moment why this is so. The second class would correspond to hxt and hxz not equal to zero, or which gives the same set of equations, hyt and hyz not equal to zero. So these are equivalent choices. And finally, htz and diagonal components and all diagonal components not equal to zero under the condition that hxx equal to hyy. All right, so when I say that the fluctuation splits in these three groups, it means the following, that of course, so here generically, right, you have, so this is a 5 by 5 matrix, right, so you have many equations, and when you actually derive it, so with using Mathematica or some appropriate package, it's actually a rather unpleasant mess. So these are, well, it's a gravitational fluctuation, so as you well know, they don't really look very pretty unless you look very carefully. And when you look very carefully, you discover the following fact, that your metric has this property. So you choose one direction, Z, as being the direction of your momentum. It was your choice. But once you made this choice, then you have these components X and Y. So you have an additional symmetry in your metric so that all the computations that you do, they don't really depend on X and Y, because X and Y, so your fluctuation, H mu nu, does not depend on X and Y. So you have this additional symmetry, and your fluctuation equations will feel the presence of this symmetry, because if you have a particular, so you can maybe say some highbrow words and say that, okay, so there is some symmetry O2, right, O2 in X and Y plane, and there is a charge related to the symmetry, not a charge, if you want, right? And of course, the fluctuations which belong to a particular value of this charge, for example, being equal to 0 or 1 or 2, they would not mix together, because you cannot violate the conservation of this charge, right? I mean, this is maybe too primitive to say these words, but nonetheless, that's more or less a correct language. And that means that you expect fluctuations which are charged differently under these O2 rotations transform into the same group and belong to the same equation. Therefore, all your equations would split into classes that are classified by values of this O2 charge, right? So this can be seen more explicitly. So let's look at this more explicitly. So this O2 classification classification of fluctuations remember that, well, H mu nu is a tensor, right, and it transforms as tensor should transform, x prime mu x sigma x prime nu h rho sigma. So if you, it is convenient to introduce the coordinates, for example, instead of x and y, z and z bar, then things become even more explicit. Z bar equal to x minus iy of the square root of 2. And then you can see how the tensor, right? So we make a transformation from x and y to z and z bar. So your tensor H mu nu component Z Z would simply according to yep. Maybe, but yes. yeah, Z, okay, so well, W will also play some role, so let me. how about Xi? How about Xi? Right, so Xi bar, right? Is it better? Right. Okay, so then H Xi Xi, right? So you just use this formula, and H Xi Xi will be HXX minus HYY divided by 2 minus I H. XY, H Xi Xi bar is H XY, sorry, H XX, H XX plus H YY divided by 2. And then H Xi bar is H XX minus HYY over 2 plus I HXY, if I think algebra is correct. But the main thing is the following. So then you do, so in terms of this variable Xi, So if I do the transformation, if I do my O2 rotation in XY plane, now in the language of the complex variable Xi, that simply means that Xi prime is rotated by e to the I phi in this O2 plane, right? So this is O2 rotation acting on Xi, and Xi bar is rotated by in the opposite direction by e to the minus I phi. So then you can see that now your new so your components xi would transform with charge 2, right? It will be rotated because there are two coordinates. It will be rotated twice, right? So again, according to the same expression, if you want. So it will be rotated with a charge 2. This thing will be rotated with a charge minus 2, but this one will have charge 0, right? Because it has one rotation in one direction, one rotation in the opposite direction. So this thing will not transform at all, okay, under the O2 rotation. So this is a conclusion that the conclusion is that HXX plus HYY, and this is nothing but the trace of our H mu, at least trace of this XY sector of XY components of the total five-dimensional H mu, the trace, right? The trace does not transform. Does not transform. And the components HXX minus HYY and HXY transform with the charges magnitude of which is equal to 2. Okay, and you can also look at the components with which has only one value of X or Y.
When you say the trace, you mean shouldn't be HX upstairs, X downstairs,
but HY upstairs. But these are XY components with Euclidean metrics. So it is the same. Right. I mean the metric is 1-1, right? So it's just Euclidean. It's a trace of a two-dimensional matrix. Which is Euclidean, right? So this O2 plane, right, is simply XY plane in Euclidean space, right? So it's not no different. Now, so again, the important thing is that you can even without this analysis, you can look at the components, right, and you can already see that, okay, so my tensor will be either affected, right? So the coordinates the components X and Y are both affected, they feel the presence of this O2 rotation. Or here we have only one component of a tensor fields, here X, and here Y or Y, right? Only one component feels the presence of this O2 rotation. So effectively, in comparison, in with respect to this O2 rotation, these components act as vectors, right? There is only one active component, namely this one and this one. And finally, diagonal terms like HZZ or HTZ do not feel, they don't have X and Y components at all, so they don't feel this O2 rotation, so these are scalars. They don't transform at all, right? So these do not transform. But because HXY can be split further, right, as a tensor, H mu can be split further into trace and a traceless part, and the trace and traceless part transform differently, namely the trace does not transform, but the traceless part does. So that explains the presence of these pieces here, and explain this thing here. So they do transform. Okay. So then the equations of motion split accordingly. Okay. So there will be a group of equations which only contain HXY. Okay. And the equation for components HXX, which are not equal to HYY. Then there will be a group of equations that only contain these components, or these components will be identical groups of equation. And there will be a group of equations which contain only the diagonal components of H mu plus HTZ. And they don't talk to each other, they don't couple, okay? Because the symmetry charge will be different for all of them, they cannot couple. Okay? So this means that we have three channels of equations, and this is helpful because we can then deal with these free channels differently. Namely, what we can do to further simplify. So we have, okay, so suppose we have this group. So suppose we have this group of equations, and in fact, maybe you should write this down. Let me see. Want to write this down or not? Yeah, perhaps I will write this down. So consider group number two, right? So this is called this group is called the shear channel. We'll see in a moment why this is so. So in the shear channel, let me also define capital HT. This is just a definition. So I will normalize my H's in some in such a way that it will be HTX times this prefactor, and then there'll be another thing, which is U over this prefactor PTL squared times H ZX, right? So TX or XT or ZX, right? So these are two components, just notation. And then the Einstein's equations of motion, they simply read, so H prime T, so it will be one equation which contains a constraint, F H prime Z equal to 0, H double prime T minus 1 over U H prime T minus, these notations will be explained in a moment, H Z minus Q bar squared U F H T equal to 0, and finally, there is a third equation, 1 plus u squared uf h prime z plus omega squared uf squared hz plus omega q uf squared ht equal to 0. Okay? Now, the notations, so first of all, of course, our f is 1 minus u squared, as before. This omega hat or omega bar is omega over 2 pi t, and q bar is the same. It's our q over 2 pi t, a dimensionless variable that will be small in the hydrodynamic limit later on. But the important thing is that, so you have a system of equations. You can show that these equations are not independent. So these are equations which follow from this R mu equal to 2/3 lambda with minus times H mu, right? So, but you can see that they form a closed set of equations, right? So HTX and HZX, they talk to each other. They don't couple to any other components of H mu, according to our symmetry classification, as we expected. You can also show, as typically happens in gauge theories, that these equations of motion are not completely independent. You can combine these two and get the third one. But we will do something different here, similar to what you were supposed to do in yesterday's tutorial with Maxwell fields, because effectively, for the shear channel, as anticipated, right, because there is only one active index here, which transforms under O2, so effectively, this is a graviphoton, right? So this is our field, which behaves similarly to a vector field, to a Maxwell field, and we are going to do exactly what we were doing in gauge case in U1 case. So recall that when you have a gauge invariance, gauge redundancy of your theory, then you can introduce gauge invariant fields, gauge invariant objects, of course, electric and magnetic field. And you can write your Maxwell's equations, obviously, in terms of E and B, right? So these will be gauge invariant variables. Now, here we have gravitational fluctuations. Gravitational fluctuations, and effectively, because they are linear, so these are linearized, so these are spin two fields. And the analog of this gauge transformation, or gauge redundancy, is the remnant of this diffeomorphism invariance. The infinitesimal diffeomorphisms that the theory is is invariant under. So we can form gauge invariant variables. Gauge invariant meaning invariant with respect to these transformations out of our HT and HZ. And in fact, this is not very different from, because these are kind of gravifoton fields, right? So the gauge invariant variable, and I ask you to do it as an exercise, right? So find the appropriate gauge invariant variable for each of the channels, right? So this is an exercise. But in this case, okay, so let me maybe formulate it as an exercise for you. Exercise. Find gauge invariant combinations. Combinations for free channels. So free channels that we discussed. And the answer for the shared channel will be Q times HT plus omega times HZ. So so here implicitly we introduced the Fourier transform. So all our fields, right, our H mu nu, which is a function of U, T, and Z, right? So this is represented as before, minus I omega T plus I Q Z, and then there is some H mu nu, which depends on U, Q, and omega integrated over d omega dq with appropriate power of 2 pi. So we are dealing with the Fourier components of the fields. And so spatial derivatives, in particular spatial derivatives and time derivatives in this transformation would be replaced by multiplication by omega and q, right? So that's hence this form of this gauge invariant variable. Now, the advantage of introducing the gauge invariant variables is that it now, so your set of equations, so now you have this, so this is, again, so think of the Maxwell case, right? You have a set of equations written in terms of the four potential A mu. Instead, you can write the one equation in terms of the gauge invariant variable, and it will be a second order equation, which you can easily derive from this set of equation by simply saying that, okay, so I know that because it is a linear combination of H's, I know that Z satisfies the second order differential equation with some coefficients alpha, for example, and beta. So I know that the equation will be of this form. So I write this down like this, and then I form linear combinations of my system of equations here and demand, right, because I know the explicit value of Z, so I substitute this Z into this equation, and I demand that this minus linear combination of these guys would be equal to zero, and that gives me the coefficients alpha and beta. So that is an exercise that I, again, I recommend you doing. But the outcome of this is the following. that I the equation for z or z1 is so I derive equations of motion for my gauge invariant variable z1, and this equation will have the following form: z1 double prime with respect to u, and then the somewhat perhaps unpleasant coefficient times f minus u omega or omega hat, or oh, I have hats there, right? So it's all not hats but bars, right? So f prime divided by uf, and here I have q squared f minus, so all with hats, minus omega squared or w squared. So this is z prime 1 plus omega squared minus q squared f, again with hats, divided by u f squared z1 equal to 0. So this is our differential equation, which is a shear channel, right? So this is a shear channel of gravitational perturbations. And you can do a similar thing, obviously, for the other two channels that we'll probably won't have time to do, but you can do it as an exercise. So let's look at the shear channel with some detail. Yep.
Question: we said before that basically the equations of motion inherit the background, basically the properties of the background.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. In this case, for dh, is it clear that the two singularities that my metric has are present on the equation of motion.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of Z1, we're introducing an extra singularity.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, that's the it's an artifact, if you want, of dealing with the gauge invariant combinations. It's not. It's true that we introduce additional singularities that actually that will complicate our life. They will not it is true that in practical, so you can, I mean, going to gauge invariant variables is a technical step, right? So conceptually, it clarifies something conceptually, but it's not something that is absolutely required or absolutely necessary to do. It is convenient in some sense, and it is inconvenient in the other sense. In particular, you're right, the appearance of these extra singularities, in this case, it won't trouble us too much. But there are other cases in far more complicated backgrounds where using the gauge invariant variables would lead to complications precisely due to the presence of these extra singularities. Now, there are ways to deal with that. I mean, one recommendation would be to go back if you are seriously in trouble with these extra singularities. You can go back and, in principle, you can solve this system of linear differential equations, and then demand sort of, because one of the advantages of going to gauge invariant variables is that your boundary conditions could be formulated in some meaningful way, because once you have something gauge invariant, right, so you demand this gauge invariant thing to be equal to something on the boundary, right, and it's not in some particular gauge, right, so the question is, right, so you choose a gauge, change the gauge, and then your boundary condition what would it mean, right? So but you can still impose the gauge invariant boundary conditions, except that you are dealing with this system, and then on the gauge invariant combination of the boundary values of that thing, you will impose the appropriate boundary condition. Okay, so you're solving this system in the bulk, but then the boundary condition you impose on the gauge invariant combination of fields at the boundary, on the boundary values of these fields. Okay. So there are some ways to deal with that, and you are right. I mean, this is an additional complication that that arises in generically in the language of gauge invariant perturbations. So ignoring this this problem for a moment, and it is a problem as I explained. So looking at our old singularities, right? So remember that we had our singularities at u equal 0, u equal 1, and then less importantly, u equal minus 1, u equal to infinity. So these are singularities plus singularities coming from this denominator. And one can to solve, so the singularities which are important for us will be singularities at u equals 0. This is the boundary of ADR Schwarzschild. And then at u equal 1, this is the horizon. U equal 1. So what you do, you impose, so you have to, because you're interested in a retarded correlation function, you impose the, so you compute the indices of the differential equation at the horizon, right? So at u equal 1 at the horizon, the indices alpha 1 and 2 are equal to plus minus I w over 2, omega hat over 2. And you know that incoming wave condition would tell you that alpha must be equal to minus I w over 2. So this is incoming wave boundary conditions. And then you write your solution in the following form. So z1 of u is equal to 1 minus u, right? So according to Frobenius recipe, you have to write down, so or u minus 1 doesn't matter. So okay, u minus 1 to minus I w hat over 2 times a function which is a regular function at u equals 1. So that's important, right? That's Frobenius theorem. So all the singularities will be regular. So these singularities will be regular singular points. And Frobenius theory applies. So in principle, you can write it like this, but it is more convenient for technical reasons. It is more convenient to write this in the form, instead of u minus 1, you write this as f, which is 1 minus u squared to power minus I omega hat over 2. Now, this is the same. It's 1 minus u times 1 plus u to the same power, close to 1. 1 plus u is simply 2. So it's a matter of normalization of your solution by a constant. So it doesn't change. It doesn't change anything. It's your choice. But it is convenient just technically to write this in this form. You don't have to do it. I mean, it's okay. Times some regular function of u. And then you take the solution and substitute into your equation. You get the equation for f. So equation, second order equation for f. And in principle, you are done, because if you can solve the equation for f, that's fine. Yeah, also at u equals 0, right? So at u equals 0 at the boundary, you compute your indices, and the indices alpha 1 and 2 are equal to 0 and 1. So you know that your solution z close to the boundary has this form. It starts with a constant, and then there are some higher powers in u plus some constant b times u. It's u and I think it's u squared, actually. I think it's 0 and 2, but you can check this. doesn't matter. So u squared or u maybe plus higher powers, and u is very small. U is very small. So one way or the other, the spectrum. So we are interested in the quasi-normal spectrum, and to find the spectrum. So looking at this equation, to impose a Dirichlet condition would simply mean that you have to put a to 0, and therefore this is equivalent in this language to say that z at 0 must be equal to 0. So Dirichlet condition simply means that z1 of 0 must be equal to 0. Okay. So the practical thing, if you're interested in quasi-normal spectrum, the full quasi-normal spectrum of the shared channel, the practical approach is the following. You take this ansatz, substitute into the differential equation, you get equation for f, the second order equation for f, and you impose your f is regular at u equals 1, and you impose the condition that f of 0 at u equals 0 must be equal to 0. So this is Dirichlet condition at the other end. Okay. And this gives you the full quasi-normal spectrum of your problem, which I regret to say one cannot find exactly by solving this equation. So it's something that you can do numerically. However, what you can do analytically is the following. And in fact, this is the only thing we are really very much interested in. You can look at the lowest. So your spectrum is infinite. It's a discrete infinite spectrum. And what you are interested in is the hydrodynamic limit of your equations of motion or of your spectrum. Because remember, our prediction was that in the hydro limit, right, in the hydro limit, we will get when omega, then q, then omega bar and q bar are much less than 1, then we expect the appearance of the poles or the quasi-normal frequencies with a specific hydrodynamic behavior. So instead of solving this, we can do, I mean, this has been done. I mean, it's not a big problem to solve this numerically and find the full spectrum. But let's, instead of this, so let's do it for in the limit of small omega and so in the limit of small omega and q, small in comparison to temperature. So this is our hydro limit, right? So we have this solution for z. So z1 of u is equal to f of u to power minus I omega or w bar over 2. And here we have some function f of u, but it also depends on omega bar and q bar. You substitute this into the equation for z, and then you solve perturbatively. You find the solution perturbatively, and the solution is, so your f of u omega bar q bar is very simple. It's 1 plus I q bar squared f of u over 2 w bar plus high orders. So in principle, you can continue, in fact, it is useful for computing the high order transport coefficients, but in the simplest case, this is just 1 plus this term. And the Dirichlet condition, so Dirichlet condition simply says that z1 of 0 equal to 0, right? And that means that this thing of 0, which is f equal to 1, and this whole thing should be equal to 0 up to the higher order terms. And that implies that w bar is equal to minus I q bar over 2 plus higher order terms. In fact, you can show that the next term will be of the order of q to the fourth. You can actually find it. And now, so that's your quasi-normal frequency, right? So again, you can do the full analysis numerically. And in the complex omega plane with imaginary part of this w and real part of the w at fixed value of the fixed value of q bar, you will find the full quasi-normal spectrum of these perturbations in the shear channel, and this quasi-normal spectrum will be some sequence of frequencies of poles, depending on frequencies in the complex omega plane, which are symmetrically distributed with respect to the imaginary axis. And you have one special frequency which sits right here on the imaginary axis, this one. So you can find it also numerically, and it has this interesting property, which is characteristic of the collective excitations of the hydrodynamic type, that the limit of W dispersion relation, then Q is going to zero. The limit of W as a function of Q is equal to zero, right? So this means that this is a hydro mode. It's a gapless mode. There is no gap, right? So hydro mode, no gap. Okay, unlike, for example, all other frequencies which you find here, and even at Q equals zero, so when Q bar is going to zero, this frequency would go to zero, but these guys will stay at some finite distance from the real axis, and nothing will happen to them, right? So they don't have interpretation of the hydrodynamic modes, as we expect. And now compare this with the QFT, right? Because that's what we did last time. So compare with four-dimensional relativistic hydrodynamics, where we had omega equal to minus I eta over s t times q squared plus higher terms in QFT. And here we have, if I reproduce, remember that omega bar and q bar are omega over 2 pi t, and q is q over 2 pi t, q bar is q over 2 pi t. So if I reinstate omega and q, I will discover that this is equal to omega is equal to minus I q squared over 4 pi t plus high order corrections, and this is the gravity result. So you compare these two, and the conclusion is that the ratio of eta over s is equal to 1 over 4 pi. Of course, plus corrections. So this is, of course, in the limit, right? In the limit when nc is infinity and lambda is infinity. Okay, so this is our main result, if you want. So our quasi-normal, lowest quasi-normal frequency would tell you what the viscosity, because S, of course, the entropy density can be calculated from Bekenstein-Hogan entropy of your solution, of your metric. So you know the result for viscosity from this calculation. All right. Yep.
Going back to the point of this new singularity, very quick, and I'm angry with that. But so I have a solution here, u equals 1, right? And so Frobenius recipe tells me that solution is only valid on a radius convergence, that is, up to the next singularity.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this new singularity lies between 0 and 1. So why am I allowed to put Dirichlet boundary condition?
Not quite. So if you look carefully, so you can analyze where exactly this singularity lies, and it is not dangerous for, I mean, it will lie in the, it will not lie on exactly on the, on in between 0 and 1. So it will lie in the. So where is it? It's F equal to W over Q squared, right? You take, then it is 1 minus W squared over Q squared, and there is a square root, and then depending on the ratio of W and Q, so you have to be careful where this, what this ratio is. Now here, you see, so you're, yeah, there is some subtlety there, indeed. So here, our omega, or our W, if you want to divide by 2 pi t, is such that omega is of the order of q squared. and both of them are small. Okay, so if you look carefully where this thing lies, it won't change. Yeah, but there is a subtlety there. I agree. Right. So okay. So fine. So we found viscosity. Great. We can also find the correlators, right? Because in principle, we wanted more. For that, we need so to compute the correlators, right? To compute the correlators. We need the action, and the action. I will write down the expression for the action, but it will require a little bit of work to actually prove that indeed the action is the one I am writing down now. Ht squared t. I will give you some references to look at if you're interested. But remember to include the Gibbons Hawking term, and there should be also a counter term because strictly speaking, the action is infinite, so you need to include the counter term to get rid of the infinite volume piece. We won't have time to go into full analysis of this, so let me just write down the correlation functions that you can compute after computing the action. So t not nod or ttt, right? So ttt, one point function, is 3π² over 8 times n squared t to the fourth, plus, of course, corrections again, 1 over lambda to power 3/2, 1 over n squared. So all I'm saying is up to these corrections, right? So then tij is π² over 8 n squared t to the fourth times delta ij plus the same time correction. So you can see that epsilon, so this is energy density. This is your energy density, and this is your pressure. Pressure times delta ij, right? So epsilon is equal to 3p holds, and this is something that you get from gravity action automatically. And you also get the correlator. So let me write at least one of them, so you can see, you could see how they look like. So for example, tx of omega n q, tx of minus omega minus q at finite temperature, and this is retarded correlator. It has this form n squared c pi t cube q squared over 8, and here we have I omega minus d q squared. All right, so there is a pole, and this pole, so this diffusion constant of momentum is 1 over 4 pi t. So this is our shear mode, right? Remember the d. Remember we had this this discussion yesterday of the meaning of these two modes. One of them was the sound mode, and another one was the shear mode. So again, so here you have 8 over s is equal to 1 over 4 pi plus corrections, plus these things of 1 over lambda 3/2 and 1 over n squared c. And you can do a similar analysis. So this is the true correlation function. You can check the worded entities and various other things. So you can compute other correlation functions as well. So what we have done here was only one out of three channels. And obviously, you want to check the last one, which is predicted to have sound waves, right? So in a similar way, so here again, so this correlator is a complicated function of omega and q, which can only be computed numerically. In fact, from gravity, it's a complicated function. But in the limit of small omega and q, it can be computed analytically, and the result The result is here. Indeed, it has a pole where it should have the pole, and the pole can be interpreted in terms of hydrodynamics. But what is interesting is that so you can compute, of course, the correlators in a different channel. So you are interested in, for example, correlator of type TTT, T not, right? So this correlator must have a pole which corresponds to the sound wave, okay? And it does. And it does. And then the last thing with which we finish is sort of, I will try to make a connection with the very first lecture, right? So this is our result for viscosity, but let's see, does it tell us anything new or anything useful about physics? So let me use, I'm trying to see which word to use. It's probably this one in the middle. Right, so remember, we started this short lecture course with saying that we know from lattice QCD that pressure, entropy, and other thermodynamic quantities appear according to lattice QCD. For example, they don't seem to be very different at weak coupling and strong coupling. They differ by about 20-25%, and this is compatible with what is seen at in heavy ion collisions. It appears to be the correct thing, but this is definitely not the case for kinetic coefficients. The kinetic coefficients differ dramatically from almost ideal gas calculations to the strong coupling limit calculation. And our result here confirmed this expectation, because so for example, for viscosity in the large N limit, we have, so we can write down this f, a function of lambda, and nc squared times t cube. By dimensional analysis, it must be proportional to t cube. And this function f of lambda, we had the same thing for entropy. Remember, with a difference of 1/4, a mismatch of 1/4 between ideal gas result for entropy and the strong coupling result for entropy. But here, this function f is dramatically different. So it has this dependence on lambda at small coupling of the following type. So this is when lambda is very small. So this result was with exact coefficient was obtained by Guy Moore and collaborators, but for other gauge theories, it is very similar. And in fact, up to this logarithm, which is very nasty and requires a lot of work, but this 1/λ² is something that you can look up at kinetic theory, basically. It's not even Landau-Lifshitz, because this is, remember that this thing's, the viscosity will be proportional to mean free path, and mean free path will be 1/1/ sigma, right, where sigma is a cross-section of interaction. So this basically is this result. Of course, a log is a rather complicated story. But notice that there is a strong dependence on the coupling constant in the weak coupling limit. It depends very strongly. So this thing is large number, first of all. But second, it has a strong dependence on lambda. In the opposite limit, in the limit of where we're getting this result from gravity, it actually independent, it is independent of lambda. So it's π/8 plus corrections, yes. Plus corrections, and here, in principle, plus corrections in the limit, in the opposite limit of large lambda. Now, so one can have this plot, which is kind of summarizing this situation. This 8/S as a function of the coupling constant in n equals 4. And again, and nc equal to infinity in n equals 4 supernumeral at finite temperature. where this dependence, a strong dependence on lambda, tells you that it goes something like that, then there is some unknown, there is a known part, and this is this limit of 1 over 4 pi. So if you reinstate h bar and k Boltzmann, then you have this. This to 1. And you know that it goes smoothly to this limit because, as I mentioned, the corrections were corrections were computed. So you can write down that 8 over s is equal to h bar over 4 pi k Boltzmann. And here we have 1 plus 15 zeta function of 3 divided by lambda power of 3 half plus higher corrections in inverse powers of lambda, which nobody computed. And I actually doubt that it will ever be done. So this is the result for n equals 4 super n pairs. Another interesting development along the same lines was the observation that when you do the computation in other backgrounds, which are dual to different quantum field theories, not necessarily n equals 4 super n Mills, then in the limit of infinite coupling and infinite n, because these are typically gauge theories, or more generically, even if you don't know what this limit corresponds to in the gauge theory, but you can say that you're working in the limit of classical gravity, then you don't take into account the stringy corrections and quantum gravity loop corrections, then you always have in this classical gravity limit, you always have for all of these theories, the limit of this viscosity entropy ratio is always equal to 1 over 4 pi. The corrections, of course, are different, as they should be, and each theory has its own coefficients in front of this. In fact, there are some theories which have this sign negative, the negative sign in front of the correction. But the point is that there is this universality. So this 1 over 4 pi limit here is universal is universal for all quantum field theories which have for all quantum field theories with gravity duals, so in the limit when gravity approximation is valid. All right. So this is a fairly interesting result. And of course, people try to compute the corrections such as this one in n equals 4 super n Mills and other theories as well. So you can think of theories with fundamental quarks, for example, or theories which have non-zero chemical potential. So you include finite density corrections and so on and so forth. But this is extremely robust. And one may wonder if this is a reflection of any sort of universality that you expect in nature, because clearly we are dealing here with very abstract models, right? I mean, n equals 4 super n Mills is a human construction, right? It's not something which is realized in your little jar in the lab. And even if you do, if you say that this is not just n equals 4 super n Mills, but it's in all theories which have a gravity dual description, it's of course a much larger class of theories, but still, it's not something that you have in your desktop experiment. So you may wonder if this universality has anything to do with the property of this physical quantity, because this is measured. I mean, this is something that is measured in the lab, which has so this universality, whether or not it has anything to do with this physical property of this quantity, which you can measure in experiment. And this is an open question. So this ratio is measured, has been measured in many substances, including liquid helium and all known gases like argon, nitrogen, water, whatever you can think of. It is measured in the cold atom experiments as well. It is indirectly measured in heavy ion collisions. And it is interesting that there is this tendency that indeed it seems that A to the rest at strong coupling, it comes closer and closer to a certain I wouldn't say to a certain limit, but I would say that sort of with increasing coupling, effective coupling, it comes closer to this 1/π result. And in fact, in heavy ion collisions, it's virtually equal to it, plus minus. Of course, there are some systematic errors and some things which cannot be taken into account systematically. So this is not a statement that you improve your experimental technique and you actually get this. But it is consistent with what is seen experimentally, and it is consistent with what is seen experimentally with in cold atom experiments as well. So it is an open question whether or not there is anything sort of any physical in this universality, or this is just a feature of this supergravity approximation, which is completely abstract and has nothing to do with the physical reality, or just appears in this class of these models. But nonetheless, I think this is an interesting result. All right, so this ends our lecture. So if you have any questions, so please ask me. I'm around until next Thursday. So please ask me. And you still have homework to do. Don't relax yet completely. Okay. Thank you.